Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how winter games in Florida are changing the way the WNBA approaches the offseason. And our Chef Talk series continues with a James Beard Award nominee and past Chopped winner. But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
On Monday night, he issued a sudden freeze on federal grants that was so sweeping, so broad, so poorly thought out that it created immediate chaos across the state of Arizona, across the entire United States.
My question would be the opposite. Why should the courts not reflect the population? Why should a state that is so diverse have a Supreme Court that looks like one racial aspect of our state?
You want to make sure you reach a threshold of support where it looks, everything looks great for the primary, everything looks good for the general, and that's when you make sure you're all in.
For now, we will cover the cost of the Isaac Elementary School District, get their payroll, and we want to send the message to the teachers that more help is on the way.
But obviously we take very seriously what she has to say. We also have the benefit, though, of seeing how it worked over the last 10 years. 6.9% still allowed the fund to nearly double in size.
We are seeing, though, overall, is there's not much of a difference between what was happening during the Biden administration and the Trump administration. And so far, this is more what it seems like to be a show, an act.
And joining me to talk about Arizona's newest Supreme Court justice, changes in the governor's office, and more are Barrett Marson of Marson Media. Good morning, Barrett.
Good Friday morning.
And Democratic strategist Tony Connie. Tony, good morning, too.
Good morning.
So Barrett, first, there's a James Beard Award winner.
Nominee.
Okay. And I got no, like, eggs with, like, some, crab or lobster in them waiting for me? Like, some beautiful dish here?
If you had put in your order ahead of time, I might have been able to help you out.
So disappointing.
Sorry, man. Sorry. Well, so speaking of not having things, the federal government might not be sending money to the states. The President Trump issued an executive order, a memo then that was rescinded, but there's still some questions about whether or not that money is coming. And Barrett, this, like, Arizona gets a pretty good amount of money from the federal government. This could be a pretty huge thing if it doesn't come, right?
Yeah, of course. I mean, every state, we all pay into the buckets and then the buckets flow this way. When dealing with, hundreds of millions and even billions of dollars, it's great to have a lot of questions and not a lot of answers. I've seen the memo, this executive order from – I'm sorry, it wasn't even executive order. It was a memo from OMB has out there, freezing everything. And then they said they've rescinded the memo, but not the policy, just the memo. And it's like it's created a lot of confusion and, we do rely on, Meals on Wheels and things like that. And, we saw that the Medicaid portal in almost every state was down. They're back up now. So there is a lot of confusion. And, before we get to Tony, who will have an immense amount of things to say about this, I will say that, this flood the zone thing that they are doing is probably pretty effective because they'll do 10 things. Three of which we will be incredibly up in arms about, three of which, we'll question about and complain and make jokes of, and then four we don't even notice. And it's, that's the point of it, right? We don't notice some of the stuff that they're doing because there's so many other things, the chaos. That's created. So.
And Tony, some of these things are things that people do notice. Barrett mentioned Meals on Wheels, Medicaid, things that people in their day-to-day lives kind of rely on.
Yeah, this is very important stuff. If there's something to get up in arms about, it's this. And the fact that people were up in arms, it's why they either rescinded or whatever it is that they did. I mean, this isn't really a freeze. They just made a decision unilaterally to stop providing resources to the most vulnerable people in our country. At the behest, apparently, of the richest man in America, maybe, or in the world. And it's just a super dangerous precedent. At least the backlash caused them to sort of back off this. But, I was frustrated that there were some Republicans that in Arizona really did a good job pushing for things like the I-10 expansion And that is one of the things that was potentially at jeopardy here with this. And that includes with like the, you know, potential of the infrastructure spending from before.
Yeah.
You know, you got a guy like Senator Shope, and he was very quiet about it. At least like, you know, Congressman Stanton sent a letter saying, hey, we need at least clarification on what on earth it is that you're going to be funding and what you're not funding, because we have stuff that we need to do. And so like, hopefully this is getting figured out, but it is, it's, you know, it's much bigger than just like a freeze. Like this was a huge problem.
Well, one of the issues I think for Democrats, you know, for about 2 months, they'd been really rudderless. This is the first time they had a cohesive message in the resistance, if you will. And it was the first time they really found some footing and able to attack Donald Trump and actually score some points. I mean, hey, the memo got rescinded, whatever that means. You know, there was some action. There were Republicans who were very concerned. You know, in Republican states, the Medicaid portals went down, right? So there was a lot of concern. And one of the things I think is, you know, we've really heard a lot about this is going to be a much more focused Trump administration compared to the first. This is going to be a much more professionalized administration compared to the first. And this was kind of bungled, whichever way.
Yeah, this felt like a fumble the way they did it.
Whatever they meant to do, they didn't do it well.
Yeah. So Tony Barrett mentioned, you know, lots of questions about a lot of money, you know, affecting the state budget. Another potential question affecting the state budget is who is Governor Hobbs's budget director going to be? Now, typically, negotiations don't really start in earnest till a little bit later in the year. But it seems like potentially a problem that the governor's Office of Management and Budget does not have a director right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's a problem in the sense that it's an important job that has a tremendous amount that you have to do in order to get the, you know, the budget approved, and you have to work with and look at the work that the previous budget director did with, you know, in previous sessions where they had to go and talk to individual Republican legislators, figure out what their like priorities are, find a way to make a deal with the leadership. And so, yeah, I think it's problematic in the sense that, like, I'm sure you would like to have a full team, but this stuff, you know, happens where people move on or, you know, it's a really not I'm going to surprise everybody with this. It's really not fun to work in government all the time, especially at that level, especially when you're dealing with like the legislature and that stuff. And I'm always surprised when people are putting in as much time as they are. I think to me, a lot of these jobs are like 2 year jobs and people are normally like, you know, stepping aside. So I don't think it's like that big of a deal that someone's stepped aside. That kind of stuff just happens.
You know, it does just happen. I've been in government. I've seen the churn. It usually doesn't happen in the middle of a budget, however. And look, I don't know. Tony may disagree, but I bet he would actually agree. The last two budgets under Hobbs have been much more Republican-centric. And I think, you know, Democrats in the legislature haven't been happy with the last two budgets, right? Some Republicans haven't been happy because it spends, you know, too much, spends a little differently than they would prefer. But Democrats have been hopping mad that the negotiations haven't been, you know, a bit more even. They've been a little bit one-sided. These last two budgets, I mean, I hear all the time that the current budget that we're in was really driven by the chief of staff for the Arizona House of Representatives. It was a Michael Hunter budget. Shout out to Michael Hunter. the Republicans really have ruled the last couple of budgets. And I think Democrats are unhappy about that. And part of that stems from an inability to really get top staff. Because, again, a budget is incredibly complicated, $17 billion, $15 billion, whatever.
It's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money. And there's it's very intricate. There's no doubt about that. It takes someone who's had years of experience. And I don't think Hobbs's budget director had that kind of experience.
Do you think the fact that the governor's budget director, Sarah Brown, stepped down yesterday, does that impact how this – the budget that will be negotiated before July 1st, does that affect that at all, do you think?
It should. It really should affect it because, again, this was the governor's point person on numbers. You know, we were talking before the show about how Janet Napolitano, former governor, would negotiate the budget herself, no staff. Katie Hobbs is not Janet Napolitano and needs the staff and needs good staff. And I don't know that she has that. But the legislature does. Michael Hunter is a budget guru. Matt Gress, who is on the House
Appropriations,
in the legislature on House Appropriations, used to be Sarah Brown,
Under
Governor Ducey. But he also had a lot of experience at JLBC, the legislature's budget arm, for years before that. So he was very familiar with a lot of agencies. He didn't just step into the role of creating a budget from nothing, right?
And he's still gotten a little bit of hot water, if you remember, when it came to the projections about the flat tax, because that was, like, not true, if you remember. Like, who was getting the tax cut, they were very manipulative back. This is, I'm talking about Matt Grass. And so, you know, I guess experience sometimes comes to the ability to try and deceive the public in order to get something through.
Well, Tony, do you think, Tony?
I don't know about deceive. You know, projections are just that. They're projections. And whether you're
well,
on
when you
or
say,
off.
Well, all right. Well,
I mean, that's like calling Governor Hobbs' budget a fraud because caseload growth was higher than anticipated. Is it fraud or were they just inaccurate?
Well, when you say that like a huge percentage of Arizonans are going to get a tax cut, but the vast majority of people won't even get the amount of money that it would take to pay for a month of Netflix, I say that's dishonest.
All right. Well, we can agree to disagree on the semantics
expensive.
Of that. Let's not throw Netflix under the bus. Tony, I mean, do you think the fact that Sarah Brown has left, is that – and maybe combined with some of the uncertainty about the availability of federal money, what does that do to the budget process, at least right now at the end of January?
Well, it becomes an all-hands-on-deck type situation. You have to fill – you're going to have to fill the role that she was serving. I mean, she's there for another couple weeks. And so things will be farther along, of course, just in that period of time.
Mm-hmm.
But this is also just not the kind of thing that one person does. And so it's not like the quarterback is gone. You know, that's not the way that it's operated in this administration, is that, you know, it's a team effort. And so I'm sure they're going to be fine going forward.
Yeah, there's a whole office, OSPB, right? There's a whole – but I would say the quarterback is the director. And now you're going to have some backup who's also untested.
All right, that is Barrett Marson. I'm also joined by Tony Conney. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The Friday Newscap continues in just a moment. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. My guest this week, Democratic strategist Tony Conney and Barrett Marson of Marson Media. Tony, there's a lot of consternation, a lot of drama this week, both at the legislature and outside the legislature about the fate of the Isaac School District in Phoenix. A lot going on. The legislature kind of stepped in at the last minute there to try to make sure that teachers would continue to get paid. This seems, I mean, I don't know what the right word for it. It just kind of seems like a big mess.
Yeah, it is a big mess. But the legislature didn't really step in and fix anything. The legislature saw, you know, Matt Grass, talking about a second, saw an opportunity to get media. He stepped up, but his bill never moved. He hasn't actually done anything. The solution to this problem looks like it came from the educators and the school with, like, you know, the deal that they're making with Tolleson that's going to hopefully, give them the cash they need in order to keep the teachers paid and the doors open. And so right now it looks like everything comes down to the treasurer, you know, John Allen, you know,
County
treasurer John Allen, where, you know, he is going to have to, you know, he should push the button. He should allow this to go through because, you know, if there isn't a guarantee of pay, I'm not sure that the educators and everybody are going to be there on Monday. Like, we got to keep the doors open. There's a real problem. I'm not trying to minimize the situation they're in, but it's not the fault of the educators. It's not the fault of the students. It's not the fault of the parents.
Well, it's certainly not any of their fault, the kids or the teachers. But it is the fault of the Isaac School District leadership. We already saw the superintendent step down.
Mm-hmm.
The Gress bill, I thought certainly it was a short-term solution. And I think the reason it hasn't moved is because Tolleson has stepped up, which I think begs a whole other question. Who knew Tolleson just had $25 million sitting around? And why does Tolleson just have $25 million sitting around that they can give to another district? I think that's odd.
They can invest. Yeah, it's an investment for them.
An investment, sure. I just think that is a strange thing that the citizens who are in Tolleson maybe should ask.
Well, it's
why
facilities
that money,
but I guess we don't need to get too.
Yeah, but why that money?
School funding is very complicated,
right.
as we all know here.
School funding is incredibly complicated.
Yeah.
To go back to our previous conversation about the budgets, it really is. But and so I think that is weird that they have $25 million. But, you know, Gress, I thought, saw much more than a media opportunity. I think he saw at least a short-term solution to ensure that teachers get paid for the next couple of weeks, next couple of paychecks. And I think that was important. The thing is, the county has floated Isaac for months to the tune of almost $30 million. It's not like the county, you know, didn't do anything, but it wasn't even their job to do something, right? It's not John Allen's job to do this. He is the bank, if you will. And Isaac just doesn't have the money. And why the Isaac School Board hadn't addressed this previously is a good question. And I think they probably need to go. And I think the important piece of the Gress bill, which should be looked at anyways, is if you're in a receivership, the board should go.
Yeah, that was one of the provisions of his bill, is that we should point out their elected school board Absolutely. Members would have basically been fired. It's going to be a lot more on that for sure. Guys, let me ask you about Governor Hobbs' state Supreme Court justice appointment this week, the first that she has, Maria Elena Cruz. Tony, were you surprised at some of the questions she got? I mean, she is a Latina. She is Black. And a lot of the questions at her announcement related to that.
Yeah, I'm not surprised because of the amount of, you know, oh boy, how do I say this? But there's, you know, there is this movement among the right that to, you know, say that anybody who gets a job that is not a white person, that it's a DEI hire. This is a very qualified person. And so I wasn't surprised that there were questions about that. I was disappointed. I was frustrated. But, you know, I mean, like, the big news here is that, like, there's now somebody appointed by a Democratic governor on the Supreme Court.
And first time
there
in a
hasn't
long time.
Been in a very
first time
long
in a long time.
Time.
And in fact, this may even be the last one for a long time. You know, I don't know if there are any more retirements coming up in the next 2 years. I don't think so, but there someone could surprise. So this may be her only stamp on the court in the 4 years.
Her being the governor.
The governor. The Hobbs's only stamp on the court.
Tony, I'm curious. You don't seem – why are you not thrilled with this pick?
No, I am thrilled with this pick.
Well, you said disappointed. Was that in the questions?
Oh, I was disappointed in the way that people were on social media, right? Social media, were being critical of her. I think she's a great pick. Yeah. I'm sorry if I misspoke. I did not mean to imply that at all.
Barrett, to the point that Justice Cruz will be the only Democratic appointed justice on the court, probably doesn't change much on the court. But I wonder, you know, Ann Scott Timmer, one of the other justices, mentioned, you know, Justice Cruz is from, I believe, Yuma. A rural part of the state outside of Maricopa County. Not a lot of perspectives like that on the court. I mean, what do you think she brings?
I actually think that is maybe more important than her ethnic background. I think being from a rural part of the state, Yuma, giving that perspective on things, though the person she's replacing was from Prescott, I believe. So
Robert Brutnell, yeah.
Right. We are sort of trading one rural for another rural. But I do think that it's important to have the rural perspective, something more than out of just Tucson and Phoenix.
Okay. Barrett, let me ask you about Senate President Warren Peterson. He filed papers to start the process of looking into a run for attorney general. He's talked about doing this before, so it's not necessarily a surprise. If he decides to jump in, that would make two Republicans who are in the primary to presumably challenge Chris Mays in her bid for re-election. Rodney Glassman has already announced that he is going to run. I'm curious, at this point, of course, this is a long way away when votes are actually cast. If it's Peterson, if it's Glassman, like, how do you see that race shaping up so far?
Well, look, Glassman has, of course, your listeners will be very familiar with him. He's run almost every 2 years. I think he took this cycle off. So he has run several statewide and county races up here. He was a actual city councilman down in Tucson. Mm-hmm. I think they're both trying to be as MAGA as possible. And, you know, it's going to be an interesting primary. There's questions about whether actually Warren Peterson, the Senate president, is actually even eligible to be the attorney general. He just got his law degree in 2023. So he's a reasonably new lawyer. And Rodney Glassman, I see, is already hitting him on the fact he has no real legal experience other than getting his law degree. He writes the laws, that's for sure. But I do think this is going to be one of the nastier elections, both primary and general, no matter who comes out of the primary for the Republicans.
I mean, the guy that hired the cyber ninjas, Warren Peterson, is going to run for attorney general. The paperwork you were talking about, finally, I thought maybe it was like to get, you know, qualified to the bar. He has no experience. He told me on Twitter when I pointed this out to him a couple of weeks ago, he said, well, but, you know, I have I've hired lawyers and they've won lawsuits. Well, that's great. I hired a plumber who came in and was able to fix, you know, my toilet and fix the issue with our shower. I don't think that that means I can go next door and say, oh, but I hired that guy and he did a good job. Don't you want to hire him? It's just a ridiculous, like, it's a kind, it's an inexperienced type of message that he's using. I imagine there's probably going to be another candidate because I can't think that these are the strongest candidates Republicans have.
You know, I mean, Rodney Glassman, he came up just short 2 years ago against Abe Hamada.
And in the primary.
In the primary. Yes, in the primary. Came up a little bit short. It was a crowded field. I think it will be a less crowded field. I think there will be some coalescing around just, you know, these top two candidates.
You don't see anybody else getting in, Barrett?
You know, look, there's anyone could sort of look in the mirror one day and say, you know, I can throw in a couple of $1 million. I can, you know. I mean, we had six people, I think, run in the Republican primary 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't do anyone well because now you're really just splitting up that and you're hoping for 20, 25% to win the race.
Do either of them, you mentioned, Barrett, that you think that it's going to be a messy race. We have just about a minute or so left. Do you see, depending on which one of them makes it out of the primary, assuming it's just those two, and assuming that Chris Mays does run for re-election as AG, do you see either of them knocking Chris Mays off?
Absolutely. Look, Tony will disagree with me all he wants, but this is still a Republican state. Even Donald Trump won, and it really wasn't that close. This is a Republican state, and while Chris Mays has been a very activist attorney general, has gotten a lot of media. Some of her lawsuits, I think, are more media-centric rather than legally sound. And so I think that will play a big part in this campaign, and she'll be very active. But I do believe, you know, you'll see a top of the ticket in 2 years that is a pretty strong top of the ticket for governor. And I think that you're going to just see a pretty big Republican sweep.
What do you think, Tony, quickly before
I think that as Attorney General, Chris Mays has done more to fight for affordability and against corporations that are trying to take advantage of consumers than any Attorney General that we've had since Terry Goddard. And so I think that if she's got a lot of good stuff to run on, she's accomplished a lot. She's really stepped up on important issues when it comes to, you know, whether it's actually going after, you know, these senior living homes that were just, you know, essentially abusing.
And the sober living homes.
Sorry.
Yeah.
You know, I think she's got a fantastic record to run on, and she will have things to talk about. And I think that the opponents will be talking about MAGA stuff. And so we'll see how it goes.
All right. That is Tony Conte, Barrett Marson. Thanks, guys, both for coming in. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Have a great day.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the legend behind the weather-predicting snake, Agua Fria Freddy. The James Beard Award semifinalists are out, and Arizona is raking them in. 15 Arizona chefs and restaurants are on the list this year, bringing some much-deserved love to the culinary world here. My co-host Lauren Gilger sat down with one of them recently in the dining room of his Scottsdale restaurant, and it's the latest edition of Chef Talk. Corey Uphold is the chef and partner at the new restaurant Course, a newish concept that aims to make fine dining approachable. He grew up on a dairy farm in Illinois and moved to Arizona after high school on a whim. Back then, he wanted to be an architect. He thought the Frank Lloyd Wright influence in the Valley made sense for him. But as he was working his way through college courses, he had a great meal at Wright's at the Biltmore, and everything changed. He told Lauren it opened his eyes to the fact that food could be more than meat and potatoes. It could be art.
It's so interesting to have somebody who wanted to be an architect end up doing the kind of fine dining food that you do. Because if you look at pictures of the kind of food that you do, that doesn't surprise me, right? Like, it is architectural. Do you see the sort of line there between those things in what you do and your food?
Oh, absolutely. Like, my philosophy is always, you know, we're culinary artists. As a chef, our job is obviously primarily to make the food taste good. But also, I feel it's important to make it look good. To have that, you know, those two worlds coincide of art and food come together, that I believe that's what we should be doing.
think that's interesting because now that I've interviewed many chefs for this series, not very many would say that. Right? Like, I think a lot of chefs try to either say, you know, oh, it's about the food or it's about the soul or it's about something else. But to approach it from like a very particularly and it sounds like pointedly artistic point of view is really interesting. What do you like about that? Like, what drew your eye to it?
And all those chefs are correct. Like, it is about the food, but it's about so much more as well. Like, a lot of these people coming out, you know, they're coming out to celebrate like a milestone or something in their lives, you know? So I feel that we should give them, you know, the best food we can, the best service we can, the best experience, the, you know, the whole package, the art, the everything, you know, that I feel the whole package is important, not just the food.
So when you're conceptualizing a dish, do you think about what it's going to look like almost as much as what it's going to taste like?
Actually, yeah, we actually sketch our dishes prior to building them. I mean, about 60% of the time it comes out the way we wanted it to. Sometimes, like, a dish will come out completely brown or completely green, and we're like, okay, we didn't think about that. So we just go back to the, you know, the drawing board and just, like, you know, add this, take away this.
What comes first, the visual or the taste or the ingredient? What drives it?
I think it's usually the ingredient and then the idea of how to mimic that main ingredient. And then from there, from mimicking the main ingredient, then we, I like to call them supporting actors. We put in those supporting actors or fundamental tastes that go with that and then kind of conceptualize the whole dish primarily around that, you know, alternating acid, salts, creamy, you know, texture elements, stuff like that.
The way you're describing it is such a mix between scientific and artistic. Very architectural, makes sense. That's like the two things come together. Give me an example. Is there a dish that you can walk us through that you remember sort of conceptualizing? What do you mean by mimicking the main ingredient?
I think one of the ones that I absolutely loved was one of our lobster dishes we had on about two menus ago. You know, it's just lobster and fennel is just the primary ingredients. But, you know, we mimicked fennel in different textures, you know, playing around with, you know, different flours or hydrocolloids, especially one is quinoa flour, mm-hmm. where it actually enables you to make wire, but it's fennel, but making it into the fryer, and it literally snaps like a wire, and it looks like a wire. It's crazy. But that's one of those dishes where it's like we taught ourselves something, a new technique that, you know, we've never done before.
Okay, so you don't become an architect. You go to culinary school here in Scottsdale, where many, many great chefs have gone. Talk a little bit about that experience and what you learned there. How did you kind of begin this career?
When I went to Scottsdale Culinary Institute at the time, and then it eventually got bought out by Le Cordon Bleu, when I went there, I never worked in a kitchen ever in my life. I just knew that's what I wanted to do. I did very well in school. In fact, I did really well in pastry as well. And actually, the pastry chef that was my teacher, she's the one that suggested I go work for Ivan Flowers, her husband, who was a chef at a different point of view at the time. And he worked under many great chefs, and he was very hard to work for. But he's the one, he was kind of like the father to me at the time of like, okay, this is how you develop flavors. And he's also the one that, you know, kind of said, hey, recipes are just guidelines. You know, you have to like look beyond the recipe, beyond the words to find the techniques. And that's what truly made me understand how to cook.
It sounds like so many people in the culinary world had like a mentor, like a father figure, a mother figure, somebody who took them under their wing and taught them. This was yours.
Yep, this was mine. Yeah, Ivan. And he was also like a great background too, because he also taught culinary school, which I eventually did as well. Eventually he said, if you ever want to own a restaurant, you know, I suggest you also go teach for a bit. That way you can more efficiently and effectively develop a crew faster. And then I did.
That's interesting. So you went to teach almost to figure out how to run a place.
Exactly. And when we're cooking, we're just, you know, in the mix of the heat. Like we can't, like you're thinking about what you're doing, but you're not really thinking. But culinary school itself, you know, in order to teach, you have to learn more. And it actually drove me to like see why food actually reacts. And I actually learned more about my style of food in culinary school teaching than I did in the field.
Okay, so what is your style? What's the definition you've come up with?
I think style is, you know, multiple simplistic items make something complex. Not making just one thing taste like one thing, because they say scientifically the human palate gets bored after the third bite. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like, you know, if we alternate like and putting, you know, five components that are simply done on a plate, the guests can mix and match and eat different styles in a way they want, you know, mixing different sauces with this or textures. So that's kind of my style, I guess.
Okay. I have to ask about Chopped because you won, which is rare. And a lot of chefs have been on the show, but not won. But also, I wonder about the decision to do that and to, like, go on television. How did you view that? Was it a door-opening opportunity for you? Was it a fun challenge? Was it a one-off?
Well, actually, they called... At that time, I was chef at Atlas Bistro, and they actually called the restaurant to see, hey, would you like to do Chopped? And I was like, oh, okay, yeah. At first, I thought it was a prank call, but then they sent me all the information. I'm like, okay, it's actually real. Went up and did the sign-up, eventually got on. It was, you know, a very challenging experience. I wouldn't say it was exactly fun. I would almost say it's more like post-traumatic stress. So it's like I'm actually sweating now talking about it. Just thinking about it. But, you know, it was definitely gratifying to win. It was a long day, though. I think we got there at 6:30 and I left at 10 o'clock at night. But it definitely opened a lot of avenues and a lot of doors for the future.
What do you make of that, the sort of Food Network or the social media phenomenon in the culinary world? Is it almost like a necessary evil nowadays?
It is. And I mean, and it's a good evil. I mean, it definitely, you know, especially with the social media and Food Network, it definitely is teaching our public, you know, to become more knowledgeable on the type of foods that we have around us. And that, you know, has opened a lot of doors for us for fine dining, where we can venture off to do more different ingredients, more different combinations that people are actually willing to try.
So there are a few questions in this series that I ask every chef because they always turn out very interestingly. But the first is more technical. Tell us about a dish on this menu that you love and why you love it.
I would say our snow dessert. You know, it has banana puree to banana bread, coffee gel to candied walnut. But then it's the thing that's completely covered in tempered chocolate. And then we powder chocolate with sorbet tapioca maltodextrin, which is a...
What? That was a lot of syllables.
Yeah, it's actually a tapioca starch that actually it powders fats. So when you melt down the white chocolate and mix it with this tapioca starch, it turns it to a white powder. And so we cover the whole dish with this white powder, and we just call it snow for our winter menu. So when people, guests get it, it just looks like a blanket of white snow, but then you crack into it and everything's down at the bottom of it. So it's more of like a surprise element.
That's really cool. Yes, a little fun with the food itself. Okay. All right. So here's one too that I always think is interesting with chefs. Do you cook at home? Like, what's in your fridge? What do you cook at home?
Eggs are always a big thing because it's quick and easy. It's healthy. Ham and cheese sandwiches, quesadillas. The food we eat at home is just like, you know, chicken done really well, sweet potatoes done really well. Just really simplistic stuff. I don't go too crazy at home.
Keep it for the restaurant. All right. Well, thank you very much, Chef, for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
A number of top WNBA players will be in action this weekend in Miami as part of Unrivaled, a 3-on-3 league started by a pair of players. Tomorrow is also the first day free agent contracts can be signed and trades can be finalized. That means there's a lot of wheeling and dealing going on around these games, including by the Phoenix Mercury. Ben Pickman covers the WNBA for The Athletic and has written about this. He joins me to talk more about it. Good morning, Ben.
Yeah, good morning.
So for folks who maybe aren't familiar with this, can you sort of break down what exactly is Unrivaled?
Sure. Unrivaled is a brand new winter 3-on-3 league that, as you mentioned, is co-founded by WNBA stars Nafisa Collier of the Minnesota Lynx and Brianna Stewart of the New York Liberty. And it is a full court game, despite it being 3-on-3, with just a modified court size. Games are played, you know, 10-minute three quarters, but it looks a lot like normal kind of 5-on-5 basketball, just a little bit more condensed and has a lot of excitement in a very intimate environment in Miami. Players get equity in the league. They're paid on average more than $200,000 a season, and it runs just 10 weeks. So it is kind of a sprint towards the finish, but the feedback on it has been overwhelmingly positive so far.
Yeah, well, and part of the goal, right, was to keep WNBA players in the U.S. and not basically force them to go play overseas in the offseason to make extra money, right?
Exactly. A lot of players historically have to go play abroad in the winter to supplement their WNBA incomes. And so this league serves as an alternative to that. It really does have almost all of the WNBA's top players participating in it. And as I mentioned, that, you know, that average salary of more than $200,000 plus league equity is allowing players to, you know, financially supplement what they make during the summer season. And so that certainly is one of the big appeals. And, you know, player experience is really important in this new league. And so they have a great weight room. They have, you know, facilities for childcare. They have a sauna, they have a steam room, they have kind of everything you would want at a professional, you know, a full-time, we'll call it professional team or a high level professional team. But they've just put it all in one place. So that was another big draw for players in deciding to participate.
So you mentioned a 10-week during the offseason. So obviously, you know, the schedule, you know, there's not a ton of time in the offseason. Is it fair to say it was just kind of a happy coincidence that all these top WNBA players would be in one place right around the time that free agency started?
I mean, it was not exactly, it was not the intended purpose of the league to have it launch right around the start of WNBA free agency, but I think that's an absolutely fair way to put it, that this is a kind of convenient piece of scheduling for the buzziness and for Unrivaled to generate even more interest, and also a convenient piece of scheduling for WNBA franchises who, so many of whom have already passed through kind of the Miami area to both support their players and support the launch of this new league, but also take free agency meetings in person in one place. That is definitely one of the benefits of so many people being gathered in one place at one time.
Yeah. So like what's it been like down there? How have teams and players been sort of handling this, you know, sort of meeting face to face, which sounds like wasn't always the way that WNBA free agency went.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, historically, you think about in, say, NBA free agency, there's this culture of, you know, maybe flying a player out and really wining and dining them. That's pretty new in the WNBA context, in part because so many players would go overseas in the winter. And so, you know, suddenly you're having to maybe board a plane if you want to recruit a player in person firsthand. So, yeah, there's definitely an added convenience factor. And a lot of players, you know, too, they're all in the same quarters, interacting with each other, building these relationships and friendships, and talking in a way that maybe they haven't in the past either, right? Some of them are teammates with other players that they're not normally teammates with. And so there have been these conversations, again, in the weight room, in the meal room, in the sauna, people told me, right? There was a lot of joking heading into the launch of Unrivaled, saying from players who are free and saying, you know, if you buy me coffee, like I might be more likely to join your team, or, you know, I'll only talk to you once you buy me a six pack of IPAs. Like there was some of that kind of lighthearted chatter. But I think it has gotten a little bit more serious, you know, as these conversations have, you know, materialized and the realities of players doing their individual business and thinking about the next stages in their lives and careers have come about. So lots of meetings around the Miami area. But yes, it is definitely the epicenter of all the chatter, gossip and deal making in the WNBA right now.
Right. Well, and that includes the Phoenix Mercury, right? I mean, Brittany Griner, who'd played here for a number of years, decided to sign with the team in Atlanta. The Mercury traded for Alyssa Thomas, who'd been playing in Connecticut. Like the Mercury are doing some wheeling and dealing down there too, right?
Yes. And the Mercury were at, I was present for the opening weekend's launch of Unrivaled, and the Mercury were present as well for the start of the launch of the league for the first couple games. Yeah, the Mercury have been very busy this week. As you mentioned, Brittany Griner, who's been a mainstay with the franchise for more than a decade, she is on the move to the Atlanta Dream, leaving the franchise for the first time ever. And we should say that like she announced her decision in a video alongside three other players on the Dream who are also participating in Unrivaled, much like Brittany Griner is. Alyssa Thomas, who's a five-time All-Star, two-time All-WNBA forward with the Connecticut Sun. She has been acquired by the Phoenix Mercury. They're going to finalize a trade that will be official tomorrow to acquire her. And, you know, she is one of the league's best players. She is also in Unrivaled, playing alongside Kalia Copper, who is also in that league. So, yeah, the ties between WNBA franchises like the Mercury and Unrivaled are very strong as, you know, the February 1 deadline approaches.
Do you see this as sort of the new normal for how WNBA offseasons and free agency and trades go down, even with the new collective bargaining agreement set to be going into effect?
Yeah, I mean, I do think as long as this league kind of exists, you know, it's safe to assume that Unrivaled will remain a hub of free agency. I mean, a lot is changing in the WNBA. A lot has changed over the last couple of years, and there will be a new CBA that likely comes into effect and heading into next offseason. And in that new CBA, the general expectation is that salaries will go way up. And so a lot of players right now are signing one-year contracts and will hit the open market again next year. And so teams are kind of positioning themselves not only for the 2025 season, but also to try and put themselves in the best position to take advantage of what sets up to be a momentous 2026 offseason.
Yeah, that'll be interesting. All right. That is Ben Pickman. He covers the WNBA for The Athletic. Ben, nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Likewise. Thanks a lot for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Every year on February 2nd, we turn to the nation's furriest weather expert to learn if we can expect a long winter or an early spring. This weekend, hundreds of people will gather in Pennsylvania for a range of celebrations, culminating in Punxsutawney Phil's prediction on Sunday morning. If the groundhog sees his shadow, we can expect six more weeks of winter. If not, sunny skies are ahead. Yes, Groundhog Day is upon us, even if it doesn't matter so much here in the desert, where we wouldn't mind if winter never ended. But did you know that Arizona has its own weather-predicting critter? Or do we? The show's Amber Victoria Singer reports.
Groundhog Day was first celebrated in the United States in the late 19th century, although historians say that rodents were used even before then to predict weather. But not in Arizona. Here, we have Aguafria Freddy, a rattlesnake who began predicting the weather in 1800. That's according to an article published in the Arizona Republic in 1975. As you may have already guessed, the story of Aguafria Freddy is an urban legend, but it's difficult to get to the bottom of Freddy's true origin story, even if you ask some of the state's leading weather fanatics, like Earl Fosdick. He spent a number of years as a storm chaser.
I was born and raised in Phoenix. I mean, I studied atmospheric science, but I did work for the National Weather Service for a while in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Never heard of Aguafria Freddy. What is it, a rattlesnake?
The National Weather Service last posted about Aguafria Freddy's predictions in February 2021.
I think it's funny, but I bet you the Weather Service wouldn't do that now.
Ed Phillips was a Valley TV and radio meteorologist for decades. He's been interested in weather since he was five, and he wrote the Arizona Weather Almanac for 27 years. Once he learned about the legend of Aguafria Freddy, he began including it in the almanac. Turns out, the pioneers had nothing to do with it.
In spite of what you may have heard to the contrary, Aguafria Freddy came out of the mind of a newspaper reporter quite some time ago. His name was Vern Pizer.
According to the 2000 edition of the Arizona Weather Almanac, the tale was first told in 1973.
I was told the story originally by a very good friend of mine. His name was Bob Baim.
Baim was a National Weather Service meteorologist. He helped Pizer come up with the idea.
And he was so excited when I started passing along the legend of Aguafria Freddy.
Just to be clear, there never was a real snake.
Well, it's a legend. It's a myth. It's all in our minds. I think it's important that our legends continue because that's part of the makeup of Arizona.
This legend stuck. For years, Phillips included Freddy in his weather almanac, and the Republic published stories about the snake's adventures, even quoting him. In 1982, Pizer quoted Freddy saying, "What the heck? No matter what happens, it's going to be nicer here than anywhere else in the country." In 2000, Arizona Republic columnist Clay Thompson called the legend a desperate bid to seem amusing that never really caught on. But in 2016, before the myth faded from Arizona's collective memory, someone created a Facebook page for Freddy. They've been posting his alleged predictions every February since.
It's just ridiculous, you know, a rattlesnake looking at its shadow.
That's Cale Morris from the Phoenix Herpetological Sanctuary. He's a native Arizonan, and he's worked with snakes for almost his entire life. But he's never heard of Aguafria Freddy.
Rattlesnakes' shadows are pretty small, too. They're only an inch off the ground. So they really wouldn't be able to see much of a shadow anyway.
The moderator of Aguafria Freddy's Facebook account did not respond to KJZZ's request for comment, but we'll be keeping an eye on that page this Sunday. For the show, I'm Amber Victoria Singer.
And Amber is with me now in the studio to talk more about the legend of Aguafria Freddy. Hey, Amber.
Hey, good morning.
So how did you find out about this?
I found this Facebook account last Groundhog Day, and I was really excited about it. I, wrote a little thing for the end of the show, and then I marked my calendar a year in advance.
That's dedication.
Yeah, well, I really wanted to know more, but I didn't have enough time to do it last year. And I just kind of, I'm not from Arizona, and I just kind of assumed that everyone here would know about Aguafria Freddy, which was actually not the case.
Yeah, we did not.
No.
So it sounds like getting to the bottom of all of this was not super easy.
No, I called the National Weather Service. They were like, "I don't know who that is." I had to look through a bunch of newspaper archives. I was really hoping that there would be like a real snake that people were looking at, and I was disappointed to find out that there wasn't.
I mean, it might be better that way, right? Because as one of the people that you interviewed pointed out, it's kind of tough for a snake to see its shadow, especially and to see much of a shadow, even if it can see any of it.
Yeah, no, Vern Pizer used to write that someone would become quite mean if they got snapped at by a rattler. And they would become, low down mean varmints, used to say.
Wow. So you mentioned that you were looking through a lot of newspaper archives. What did these articles about Freddy used to say?
My favorite article that I found was from 1984. I guess that there was like a nationwide search for a mate for Punxsutawney Phil. And Freddy responded kind of in a rude way by showing off his mate, Frida. And there's like a comic drawing of Freddy wearing a cowboy hat and Frida wearing a wedding veil.
Really?
Yeah, it's very cute.
That is going all out.
Yeah, Freddy would kind of like harass Phil a little bit. He'd be like, yeah, you quit, give up the rat race, like come to the Valley of the Sun, like kind of poking at him.
Wow, like Groundhog Day trash talking.
Yeah, a little
That's
bit.
That's intense.
A little bit. Yeah, he would, Vern Pizer would weave quite the web for Freddy.
All right, we'll watch to see what Punxsutawney Phil and maybe any other weather-predicting creatures come up with on Groundhog Day. Amber Victoria Singer, thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for this episode of The Show Podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.